Good afternoon, David Amigoni. David Amigoni, you're a specialist of Victorian literature and you teach at Keele University. And today you're here with us to discuss the impact and manifestation of Gothic in the Victorian novel, and we'll focus mainly on Wilkie Collins's The Woman in White, his novel which was published in 1860, and Charles Dickens's Bleak House. So first, what should we call these two novels? Are they mystery novels or sensation novels? Could you explain to us the signification of these terms?
Well, thank you very much for inviting me to do this, Sophie. It's a great pleasure to talk about this subject matter. In response to your first question, I would say that Bleak House could be said to be a novel of secrecy rather than necessarily a novel about mystery, although, of course, it has a mystery at its centre, the mystery of the identity of Lady Dedlock, but also the mystery of the identity of Esther Summerson, the main female narrator. You could say that this novel with a secret, this novel about mystery, which is very much organised along the lines of discovering the nature of the secret, and that's something that's enacted very carefully through a complex narrative, paves the way for what we come to think of as the sensation novel of the 1860s. And there's an argument to say that Wilkie Collins's The Woman in White, one of the novels we're going to talk about today, is perhaps the first sensation novel. So would it be useful if we said something about perhaps what the sensation novel consisted of? Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose if we're thinking about Gothic as one of the origins of sensation fiction, which I think that it is, perhaps what Wilkie Collins's novel does is to take some of those ingredients of the late 18th century, early 19th century Gothic novel, which were designed to enact all the experiences of fear and terror that we see represented in the characters of that fiction, and it proposes to take those same kinds of experience, translate them into something that can be read by a reader, but I think it does it in a rather different context. I think there are two factors that are significant here, and if we take the example of Walter Hartwright meeting the woman in white at the very beginning of Collins's narrative, then I think that helps to illustrate what we mean. First of all, what happens is that Walter Hartwright meets the lady who turns out to be Anne Catherick on a road in London. She's completely isolated. What it does to him is that it induces a feeling of terror and shock, mm-hmm. because this is a completely unknown situation. Now, Collins himself remarked that he'd read in a newspaper about such a meeting between a man and a woman. It was part of what prompted the story of The Woman in White. He'd read it in a newspaper, and I think that begins to illustrate one of the contexts for sensation fiction in the 1860s. It derives from sensational stories from an emerging newspaper culture, and particularly a popular newspaper culture. So that's one way in which we can talk about sensation fiction. I think the second way that we can talk about it relates to the whole issue of nerves and what might be called the medicalization of sensation that was going on in the middle of the 19th century. And I think that offers a contrast to the later part of the 18th century and the early 19th century, when Gothic, in its more modern manifestation, has its first major outing. I think some of the original kind of ideas about the terror And the fear that were prompted in, that were represented in Gothic fiction in that earlier manifestation can be linked to romantic ideas about the person, the sublime, and so on. But I think by the time we get to the middle of the 19th century, we're looking at a culture which is becoming increasingly preoccupied with medical ideas about the nerves, the sensations, and perhaps what this reveals about people who are living in a context of modernisation, which is leading increasingly to anxiety, uncertainty about identity, uncertainty about status. And so the very, very careful description that Collins gives of the sensations that Walter Hartwright experiences when he meets the woman in white in that first part of the narrative, I think can be linked to both of those contexts, the sensational story in the newspaper, but also the idea of sensational medical understandings of the nervous systems and what that said about the person.
Well, what's interesting is that here you've insisted on two particular kinds of discourse, newspaper culture on the one hand and medical discourse, and you've insisted on two very modern forms, and yet we know that Gothic fiction in its earlier manifestation is linked to the past. There is this idea of a feudal past which is both rejected but also which is clearly fascinating to these Gothic characters. So how do you reconcile these two ideas? The fact that we've got a tale of terror as well, which is inherited from Gothic fiction, and yet this modernity in its use of the scientific discourse and this newspaper culture?
It's a very interesting question, and I think it has to do with a certain kind of constancy in Gothic discourse, and that's a constancy of the idea of the past, and as the past as the phenomenon which haunts you. Because, of course, I think whenever we're talking about Gothic, we can never get away from, you know, the core idea that this is about the supernatural, this is about ghosts, this is about hauntings. And I think that while all of this is happening in the context of a modernising society, both in Collins and in Dickens, we still have the idea of a past which is there to haunt us, to return to us, and to confront us with our worst fears. And we can probably take two examples of that, both one from Dickens and one from Collins. Perhaps the best example of the invocation of Gothic conventions in Bleak House is the aristocratic house called Chesney Wold, where Lady Dedlock lives with Sir Leicester Dedlock. And what we have in that house, which really reminds us of the Gothic, is a space called the Ghost Walk at the top of the house. Now, that Ghost Walk links us back into the English Civil War of the 17th century, of a deep and bitter family quarrel which ends in the death of a woman. And it is suggested that the Ghost Walk, when the Ghost Walk is being walked by the spirit, then it's the spirit of this woman haunting Chesney Wold. Well, of course, I think what we're getting by that kind of parallel tale is the idea of the past coming back to haunt the present. And of course, Lady Dedlock is the same, or rather the reincarnated woman who will bring disquiet and shame upon the name of Dedlock. So that's the idea, I think, there of the past returning to haunt us. If you take the example of the woman in white, the woman in white starts in there's a remarkable sense of modernity and modernisation in this novel. For a start, the characters wouldn't be able to do the things that they do without the use of the railway, which is transporting them from the south of England up to Cumberland and so on. But it moves away from that quite quickly to a sense of the past, which is invoked by the idea of Blackwater Park. Mm. The space of Blackwater Park is the country residence of Sir Percival Glyde, of the Glyde family. Blackwater Park is very interesting because it has pretensions towards an old house that is being modernised, and Marion Halcombe at one point in her diary talks about the kind of modernisation of this old house and how what a wonderful thing it is in the 19th century to have all these kind of modern conveniences. And yet at its heart it has this old Elizabethan dark structure. And again, I think that's the idea of the past coming back to haunt modernity. There are certain things, certain drives, certain desires and so on that we have that cannot be abolished by modernization. And so, you know, I think it's that kind of idea that we return to.
And talking about Gothic conventions, here we've talked about the ghostly figures that we find in Bleak House and the woman in white. Both Chesney Wold or Blackwater Park are haunted places. But what about the supernatural? How has it evolved since the early Gothic fiction of the end of the 18th century? Do we talk of the same irrational phenomena, or how can we describe this kind of supernatural in the 19th century?
There's a very interesting example of this in Dickens's Bleak House. There's a character called Mr. Crook who runs a very seedy shop and also owns a residence in which a number of the characters who are, you know, occupy various places in the very complicated novel who inhabit that shop. Mr. Crook is also a kind of odd inversion of the authority of the law, because Bleak House is a novel that's very much about the legal system and what it's like to enter into it. And he's parodied as a Lord Chancellor, so he is the kind of parodic figure of this main authority figure of the English Law of Chancery. What happens to Crook is very interesting. He spontaneously combusts, and there's no doubt that his home, his space is very much a kind of space of Gothic darkness. There's a sense of mystery associated with him. He has a kind of cat, which is more like a familiar in some sense, that kind of crawls around his shoulder. He spontaneously combusts, and his spontaneous combustion is discovered by a range of characters who are all searching for the secret that will explain the mystery of Jarndyce and the position of Lady Dedlock. What's very interesting about this episode is that it gives rise to a very big controversy about whether or not it was right for Dickens to represent a character coming to such an end, because there's a sense in which this is an unproven phenomenon, and I suppose what we have behind that idea of an unproven phenomenon is the force and authority of modern science, of positive science, being unable to account for this particular phenomenon. And so I suppose that Gothic, the irrational, the supernatural, falls into a rather different kind of regime of truth in the middle of the 19th century. And I suppose what surrounds it is a public culture which is likely to be less accepting of the more traditional machinery of Gothic fiction. I mean, there's a sense in which, in Collins, the Gothic machinery is not really producing the same, quite the same kinds of levels of uncertainty. There is always, I think, in Collins, some kind of naturalistic explanation, but nonetheless, we're always being taken along for the thrill of the sensation of seeing the resolution of that in action. As I say, I think Dickens perhaps still does appeal to a sense of mystery, to the possibility of the irrational and the supernatural. But as I say, I think the public culture within which he was doing it was more open to making a challenge upon him.
So could we say that the function of the supernatural has changed? The supernatural was the very means to create this delightful thrill in Gothic fiction, in the early Gothic fiction, whereas now the supernatural is used for something else. It is used to define a different regime of truth, as you said.
I think that's right. I think that's increasingly what we are seeing. But I think also, going back to one of the points we made earlier about the position of Gothic machinery in this new kind of context, particularly in a modern context, I think that the supernatural and the irrational has to be left there in some sense as the space or the idea that the modern cannot quite contain. It's almost the kind of residue that, as we said before, returns to haunt. So I mean, I think that it's operating that kind of function.
Right. And could you say a few words about the Gothic landscape, the Gothic landscape, which is such an essential element of Gothic fiction in the novels by Radcliffe or Walpole, were used to this these extremely wonderful descriptions.
Absolutely.
of Gothic castles and
yes.
Gothic forests.
Yes.
So which are no longer to be found in the Victorian novels. So how has the Victorian, the Gothic landscape evolved in the Victorian novel?
It's been evolved and it's been transformed. Bleak House opens with a wonderful description of urban London on a terrible wet November afternoon, which is just descended by and obliterated by fog. And I suppose that's perhaps Dickens's reworking of the idea of the Gothic forest, because there will be terrible tangles, of course, in this novel, and we will not get to an easy solution to the various narrative mysteries that are invoked. So what I think Dickens does is to evoke the idea of the urban as a kind of forest space that really kind of obscures any possibility of truth. Of course, some of those kind of classic Gothic landscapes are still there. I mean, Chesney Wold is a space, the old aristocratic house, that very clearly kind of evokes those ideas. When we look at Collins, I think we're looking at a rather different kind of invocation of the Gothic landscape. If in the 18th century we still had in Anne Radcliffe's fiction, for example, we still had the idea of the Gothic castle that could incarcerate the heroine, this has changed significantly, but still, I think, has some sense of the past speaking through it. Because, of course, what we get in Collins is the idea of a domestic and often suburban kind of space within which modern marriages are experienced. And so it goes back to my point about Blackwater Blackwater Park being a house that's being modernised, that's being made comfortable and so on. But I think this idea of the domestic space that Collins is invoking is constantly kind of undercut by and haunted by a gothic past, because of course what's happening to Marion Halcombe and Laura Fairley, the two central female characters in the Woman in White, is that they are still precisely incarcerated in what is ostensibly the marital home. And I suppose what happens then is that the traditional Gothic spaces are used to interrogate perhaps some of the forms of subjugation and so on that were taking place in 19th century marriage under a kind of a regime of patriarchy.
Mm-hmm. So there is a political significance to this doubling of the Gothic landscape, which still appears in our Victorian novels through on the one hand, the traditional Gothic landscape of Blackwater Park or Chesney Wall, and then on the urban setting of foggy London in Bleak House.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
With could you say a few words about the aristocracy in Bleak House and
We could talk about the aristocracy in both
yes.
novels.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I mean, Chesney Wold, as I've said, is the kind of classic Gothic space, I suppose, in Bleak House, and Sir Leicester Dedlock is really a sort of satiric figure for Dickens. The very term Dedlock, interestingly, as I discovered recently, comes about in the 1840s. It's a word that's coined in the 1840s to actually try and encapsulate the idea of deadlock between parties to a dispute, and presumably that was arising because of disputes over land and so on, over the building of railways and so on. So there's a sense in which Leicester Dedlock, in having that name awarded to him in 1853, is very much a figure of his time, and perhaps what he points to is the deadlock between some kind of idea of middle-class progress. Esther Summerson and Alan Woodcourt are quintessentially, you know, a middle-class solution to the problems novels. And Sir Leicester Dedlock represents the past, an old aristocratic feudal order, which at one level hails from the Gothic, all the kind of oppressions associated with the Gothic past. But for Dickens, we're really actively preventing solutions to problems of governance in Britain, because of course the Parliament in Britain was still very much an aristocratic land-based institution. So that you can see that idea of the aristocracy as a kind of a feature of Gothic being a part of Dickens's political critique, but in some ways quite a confused political critique, because Dickens's own politics, I think, were by no means straightforward. And then if we come on to think about The Woman in White, what we have in The Woman in White is the idea of a corrupt gentry, really, through the figure of Sir Percival Glyde. Sir Percival supposedly comes from a good family, has his country estate and his country house, but of course what underlies Sir Percival's identity is precisely no identity at all, because he is illegitimate. He cannot lay claim to the house that is supposedly his. And so there's a sense in which in Collins, aristocratic authority is very much a kind of a fiction, which can only be sustained by spinning other fictions, using other people's identities.
Mm. And to further develop your analysis of the symbolic significance of the name Deadlock, we'll refer everyone to the first description of Chesney Wold when My Lady Deadlock is back to Lincolnshire Place, and you've got this wonderful description in which, everything is at a standstill, nothing's moving, and Lady Deadlock is stuck behind a window. Mm-hmm. Stuck by the rain. Yeah. You've mentioned Marion Halcombe and Laura Fairley. How can you explain the fact that the Gothic heroine seems to have split into two different figures here, and so does the villain. The villain is now embodied both through the figure of Count Fosco and Sir Percival Glyde.
That's a very interesting question. I think it perhaps has something to do with the way in which Collins, if we focus on the woman in white, is reworking versions of Victorian ideology, particularly Victorian domestic. Well, let's say Victorian gendered ideology, and I'll develop that as I go along. We know, of course, that Gothic is traditionally a wonderful form for exploring and exploiting the idea of the double. And I think what Collins does is to take the idea of the double and to use it to different ends, with, first of all, Marion and Laura, and then with Sir Percival Glyde and Fosco. Maybe if I just talk about Marion and Laura to begin with. Now, obviously, you've got a kind of a classic idea of the Gothic double in Laura Fairley and her likeness, her biological likeness, mm-hmm. as it turns out, to Anne Catherick. But I think Collins is also playing around with the idea of doubling, pairing, and so on, by making Laura into really the passive principle of femininity, but showing Marion as the kind of active and perhaps more transgressive figure who stands against the tradition. I wouldn't say traditional, but the kind of emerging principles of passivity, attachment to duty, and so on that Marion represents. So Collins seems to me to be taking the figure of the kind of ideal woman and using the idea of the Gothic double to both split the notion of the heroine and also to interrogate certain kinds of ideas about, received ideas about femininity. If you take Fosco and Percival Glyde, that's a very interesting kind of division of the villain, and perhaps what it points to is the idea, perhaps in Sir Percival Glyde, of the kind of underlying anxiety about status, financial position, that perhaps kind of underlies a lot of respectable crime in the 19th century, but also in the figure of Fosco you have perhaps the emergence of the idea of the professional criminal, somebody who is actually has a philosophy of crime, an aesthetics of crime, indeed. Yeah, very good point. And can articulate a whole kind of rationale for it. And again, perhaps this points to ways in which the classic figure of male villainous power has to be seen as dispersed across a number of different fields of activity and identity in the 19th century, that it can't all be concentrated in this one masculine figure of power, which I suppose is the kind of traditional idea in late 18th and early 19th century Gothic. So yes, I think that's how Collins Collins is using the idea of the double in that form.
And could this complex treatment of characters, this complex use of traditional Gothic characters like the persecuted maiden and the villain, does it also apply to the narrative itself? Because both with Bleak House or The Woman in White, we deal with extremely complex narrative forms. So would you like to?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think underlying your question is as well that sense that in Gothic fiction generally, we come upon this idea of the discovery of some kind of manuscript or some kind of tale, which is then mediated by a frame narrative. And yes, I think that kind of idea is invoked again by Dickens. Dickens famously in Bleak House, of course, writes two parallel narratives. They narrate the same story, deal with the same characters, but from two very different points of view. One from the point of view of Esther Summerson, the heroine of the story, and the other from a more impersonal third-person narrator, who interestingly narrates in a version of the present tense as well. So yes, absolutely. Dickens's narrative can't tell the story straightforwardly. There have to be many layers to this narrative and many turns. Collins, I think, does something similar, but is perhaps playing around with our ideas of legal documentation and legal authority. If it was possible once just to find the fragment of a tale, in Collins's case, what one is increasingly doing is finding the fragment of a case, the fragment of a particular testimony that links into a bigger story, which one person doesn't command, but when they are put together from multiple viewpoints, then perhaps the reader has the chance of commanding the entire chain of events. But it is very much the idea that there are documents out there that speak the truth, that have some kind of legal authority and standing, but they may be concealed and they may also be misinterpreted.
Or they may be wrong.
They may be a fiction, exactly, yes. in the case of the marriage register and Sir Percival's
identity. Or the tombstone.
Or indeed the tombstone. Should we talk a little bit about the tombstone, which
in
I think...
In
The Woman in White, which is, I think, one of the classic kind of Gothic images of the 19th century. The context of this particular moment is that Walter Hartwright, who has been driven abroad by his loss by the loss of Laura, returns, and of course we know that in Walter's absence there has been this successful, as it turns out, attempt to steal Lady Glyde's identity. Sir Percival, taking advantage of the fact that Anne Catherick looks very like Lady Glyde, has in fact buried Anne Catherick under the name of Lady Glyde. And so we have this wonderful scene in a graveyard, Walter approaching a tomb, and he sees before him, I saw two women, they were looking towards the tomb, looking towards me, too. They came a little on and stopped again. Their veils were down and hid their faces from me. When they stopped, one of them raised her veil. In the still evening light, I saw the face of Marion Halcombe. What then transpires is that Walter goes on to have revealed to him the fact that the grave which speaks the name of Laura Fairley, Lady Glyde, has behind it the living figure of Laura Glyde, so that the woman buried in that grave is not indeed the woman whose name it announces. It's Anne Catherick instead. So again, we get these ideas of doubling, and we get the idea very much of the kind of shock and horror that this crime of identity theft should have taken. And so just to read the final part of the passage: "The voice that was praying for me faltered and sank low, and then rose on a sudden and called affrightedly, called despairingly to me to come away. But the veiled woman had possession of me, body and soul. She stopped on one side of the grave. We stood face to face with the tombstone between us. She was close to the inscription on the side of the pedestal. Her gown touched the black letters." What a nice touch that is. You know, the idea that the physicality of clothing can touch the epitaph announcing one's death. "The voice came nearer and rose more passionately still. Hide your face, don't look at her. Oh, for God's sake, spare him. The woman lifted her veil." And then we get a representation of the inscription on the tomb: "Sacred to the memory of Laura, Lady Glyde." And then Walter Hartwright's narration carries on: "Laura, Lady Glyde, was standing by the inscription and was looking at me over the grave." So the dead are still living. You know, kind of wonderful moment of Gothic terror and shock.
Mm-hmm. We've insisted here on the complexity of the narrative form, and we've just had an example of the narrative of the tombstone as the section is entitled. Well, maybe now we could move on to something different, to a short story, Dickens's short story entitled The Haunted Man and the Ghost Bargain. So we no longer have such a complex narrative, not as many subplots as we had in Bleak House, and yet it's a very tale of terror with the ghost figure which is at its centre. How does the Gothic work here in this short story if we compare it to what we have in Bleak House?
Well, I suppose what we could say that we have in Bleak House is the Gothic as used to analyse and critique in many ways certain social problems associated with modernisation. And to that extent, it's a very ambitious narrative. I think that Dickens is Christmas narratives or Christmas tales from which The Haunted Man, from which it comes, they have a slightly different function. They are pieces of short fiction, and for a long time, perhaps, were not valued as much as the longer, more ambitious fiction. The Haunted Man or the Ghost's Gift comes from the same sort of series as A Christmas Carol, for example, which I think will be very well known to many people. But I think that what Dickens perhaps does with the short story form is to announce or issue a kind of quite carefully focused conceit, which he then uses the short story to explore. Now, we have a lot of Gothic machinery in The Haunted Man, in that the tale takes place in an old endowed educational establishment, endowed from the Elizabethan period. So we've got that kind of idea of Gothic space again, and of course we have all the darkness associated with it. At the heart of the story is a chemist, a scientist, so again a man of modernisation, whose name is Redlaw. And what Redlaw is haunted by is a double of himself, effectively. somebody, a figure who comes out of the darkness of a night time. And in the Christmas context in which the tale unfolds, issues Redlaw with a particular challenge. And the challenge is that if Redlaw agrees, then the ghost's gift will be to remove all traces of memory from him. And again, I think this illustrates the fact that Gothic hauntings are not just hauntings of spirit figures. Clearly, this is the case in The Haunted Man, but the fact that we are haunted by our pasts. Redlaw agrees to this, and so all traces of the memories that are really haunting him are removed. But the ghost also has another part of his pact, another dimension to his gift, which is that anybody that Redlaw comes into contact with will have the same effect placed upon them as well, that they will lose their memory. And really what Dickens's tale then explores is not so much the Gothic machinery itself. The Gothic machinery actually occupies quite a small part of the early part of the narrative. What Dickens then goes on to explore is what it is like to live in a world without memory, and the way in which that destroys and debases what Victorians would have referred to as the primary affections, the sympathies that one builds with the past, the sympathies that one builds with one's loved ones. And what the narrative traces is the effect that the removal of memory has on a whole variety of characters associated with Redlaw, including the working class Tetterby family. Ultimately, the ghost's gift is removed. It's a poisoned gift, and the narrative ends with a positive resolution. But I would say that this is a rather different use of Gothic to the kind of use that Dickens makes of the conventions in Bleak House, and that Collins makes in The Woman in White, insofar as it reflects very much on memory as a kind of constitutive capacity of the human. And so it's an exploration of what it would be like to live without memory. And to that extent, perhaps points us towards the kinds of reading that a later tradition of psychoanalytic works makes for us.
So the Gothic machinery is only a starting point, a tool or a pretext.
I think so.
And in fact, instead of a tale of terror, we've got a metaphysical tale about memory and about the past.
And I think you could say that the Christmas Carol, which is often treated as a rather light text, actually, if it has a serious dimension to it, and I think that it does, then it's working out of the same kind of technique, because ultimately, in the end, what Scrooge has to recover is memory, memory of a past that has been buried. And to that extent, I think it makes it quite a radically optimistic text.
Right. Well, thank you very much, David, for your enlightening analysis, which will be most profitable to all of us, especially as we'll be able to refer to all the extracts we've talked about, which will be available on the site. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for talking to me. Thank you.